loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, we discuss Gina Haspel's hearing today. She's Donald Trump's nominee to be CIA director. We're going to talk about what she told Congress, and we'll also try to assess what's the likelihood of her confirmation. And then in our second segment, we have Beyond Nuclear with Kevin Camps, a segment that we run every Wednesday. We discuss with Kevin Camps, a foremost expert on nuclear energy and nuclear weapons, the big issues of the day. Today, we're concentrating on Donald Trump's pulling out of the Iranian nuclear deal yesterday and what the fallout of that will look like.
But before we get to those two stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is on his way back from Pyongyang with three former American prisoners in tow. Pompeo was in North Korea for meetings that would lay the groundwork for President Trump's upcoming meeting with Kim Jong-un. Meanwhile, Kim was in Beijing consulting with the Chinese for the same reason. Next, mainstream Republicans and Democrats won most of their races in primaries yesterday in West Virginia, Ohio, Indiana, and North Carolina. Don Blankenship, the mining company CEO, jailed for a year for his role in the deaths of 29 miners, lost his race for U.S. Senate in West Virginia. Former Consumer Financial Protection Bureau Director Richard Cordray won the Democratic nomination for governor in Ohio. Vice President Pence's brother won the Republican nomination for a congressional seat in Indiana. And incumbent Republican Congressman Robert Pittenger of North Carolina lost his race to a far right-wing former pastor. Then Stormy Daniels' attorney is alleging that Trump attorney Michael Cohen received $500,000 from a company controlled by a Russian oligarch, with the money being deposited into an account for a company that was in turn used to pay off the adult film actress. And CNN is reporting that Robert Mueller's investigators have questioned an unnamed Russian oligarch about payments into that account. And then yesterday, a global trending hashtag on Twitter was hashtag tamam, or enough, in response to Turkish President Erdogan. Erdogan has called snap presidential elections on June 24th, and polls show that he may be in jeopardy. And finally, as Donald Trump pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal yesterday, Israel sent missiles into Syria targeting an Iranian base. This morning, there are reports of 15 dead, including 8 Iranians. Israel's military, the Israel Defense Forces, announced that they were opening bomb shelters in anticipation of retaliation from Iran. And in other headlines, Donald Trump told reporters today that the highly anticipated summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un would not take place in the demilitarized zone along the border between North and South Korea. The demilitarized zone was one of several venues under consideration. Singapore is now widely expected to host the meeting. Paraguay announced today that it would be following the United States' lead and moving its embassy in Israel to Jerusalem. Guatemala is the only other country to have made such a move following the Trump administration's announcement last December. Jerusalem's status is hotly contested, and the entire city has been under Israeli occupation since 1967. Three Mexican soldiers were found dead today in the state of Guerrero. The mayor of the town was found dead the same day, although officials are unsure if those are connected. Dozens of candidates in Mexico's July 1st elections have been killed since September. Mexico had 25,000 homicides last year, a record for the nation, and many candidates are talking about public safety in their campaigns. Saudi Arabia's Minister of Foreign Affairs, Adel Jaber, said today that if Iran works toward building nuclear weapons, Saudi Arabia will do the same. This comes the day after Donald Trump pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal, and there appears to be debate in Iran among political leaders as to whether Iran should stay in the deal with France, Germany, the United Kingdom, Russia, and China. Those are today's headlines. Next up is a discussion about Gina Haspel's confirmation hearing today. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
But first we turn to Capitol Hill and the Gina Haspel hearing. Gina Haspel appeared in open session before the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence today in her much-anticipated confirmation hearing. Haspel made no major mistakes during the testimony, but she said that on her watch, the CIA will not reinstate a detention and interrogation program. She did not, however, promise to respect changes in the Army Field Manual. And she also did not express any regret for her role in the George W. Bush administration's torture program overall. We're joined in studio by Chip Gibbons. He is a policy and legislative counsel for Defending Rights and Dissent, as well as a journalist. And he's contributed to The Nation, Jacobin, and the book, The Henry Kissinger Files. Welcome back, Chip.
Thank you so much for having me again.
So what do we make of this? Were there any surprises at all? I tried to watch the entire thing, and the only thing that I suppose I was moderately surprised by was the fact that she never apologized for anything.
I actually think there were some key takeaways from today's hearing. She was extremely evasive to all questions. Susan Collins had asked her, if Donald Trump ordered you to waterboard someone, would you do it? Her response was, I don't think Donald Trump would do that. That's an interesting response. And also Senator Wyden, who started his questions off by noting that it was indicative of the hearing that she got to decide what the American people knew about her. And she's acting CIA chief right now. So she is responsible for declassifying information about herself. And she refused to be conflicted out of that. He asked her a very specific question about, did you in 2007, which would be post Abu Ghraib, post the McCain-Feingold Amendment, advocate an expansion of the CIA torture program? And it's not clear what he was referring to, but it's possible that he knows something we don't because he has access to classified information.
The conventional wisdom is that the program ended in its entirety by 2005. That would have been under Michael Hayden. So maybe he does have access to something that the rest of us just don't know.
It was an extremely specific question. A lot of people are talking about it because he specifically stressed, did you in 2007? Did you in 2007 advocate expanding the program? And we know from the Washington Post that Haspel almost backed off for confirmation. And it happened after Trump administration officials got questions from Congress that brought new information to light that we previously didn't know about her, that showed her as being an even more enthusiastic supporter of the torture. And we already know she was an enthusiast for torture. So the fact that the Trump administration officials found out new information last weekend that was shocking to them is really very unsettling. Obviously, they're going into the closed session. They're probably having it right now as I'm talking to you. So, you know, it's unfortunate that we don't know a lot about Haspel. We know what we know is through piecing together memoirs and people's sort of doing piece work with the Senate Intelligence Committee report, the part of it that was released. So, I mean, putting this torture issue aside, and I think that disqualifies her, you know, we shouldn't be approving her when we don't know very much about her publicly.
Gina Haspel does not like you, John.
No, she's made that clear, abundantly clear.
Well, you wrote that op-ed, and the title was, this was back in March, I went to prison for disclosing the CIA's torture. Gina Haspel helped cover it up. Now, that op-ed, as you and I have discussed, was widely circulated. Lots of people were inspired by it. It catalyzed an opposition, not just within grassroots and progressive circles. I think it partly helps explain why even retired generals and admirals and, you know, high up military officials also have taken an initiative. And then Gina Haspel was obviously, I mean, they were trying to discredit the op-ed. This
yes.
got the whole thing going. But she mentioned you today.
Yeah, and she mentioned me in a way that I'm sure she didn't intend. She said that in response to a question from Senator Heinrichs of New Mexico, he asked her about the tapes that she ordered destroyed. Why did she destroy them? Was she in them? Was somebody...
These are tapes of torture.
Of torture, of the actual torture sessions. She said that she was not in the tapes, but she was afraid of an unofficial release of the tapes, which would have compromised the identities of the torturers. But what she said was that I had been prosecuted and imprisoned for revealing the torture program. Well, in fact, I wasn't. I mean, not technically. I pleaded guilty to violating the Intelligence Identities Protection Act. I have maintained all along that my prosecution was exactly because I had exposed the torture program. But the CIA and the Justice Department have been denying that for the last 6.5 years. Now, Gina Haspel just confirmed it. So I was right all along.
Let's listen to Gina Haspel talk about you, John Kiriakou.
Why couldn't the agency have simply digitized that video and then blacked out the faces of any agents in those videos? Why actually destroy the videotapes? Doesn't that feel like a cover-up, even if it isn't?
Senator, I don't think we were worried about official release. This was at a time when the entire program was the subject of unauthorized leaks, and someone was found guilty of those unauthorized leaks. So the concern was an irresponsible leak of our officers' faces to the world, not an official release.
There it is. I'll take it. She can couch it in whatever language she wants, but I'll take it. That's an admission.
Yeah, that is an admission. Go ahead, Chip.
Yeah, I mean, the destruction of the tapes is another problem with Haspel. I mean, she claims that with the torture, she was just following orders. That's part of her defense, although she refused to say the program was immoral today. She was asked a number of times.
Yes.
And she would not point blank. She just goes, oh, the CIA conforms to the highest moral standards. Oh, my father is a retired Air Force member, and he's watching this on TV, and he's very moral. It's like, okay. But, I mean, she was involved in the destruction of the tapes. She wrote the cable ordering to do so. According to John Rizzo, who was a CIA lawyer, she lobbied him repeatedly to do so. Alberto Gonzalez told her not to destroy them. David Addington, who was Cheney's chief of staff, who was very pro-torture, not a civil libertarian, also told her not to do so. Jane Harman, who was a member of the Congress at the point, asked her not.
She was the chairman of the Intelligence Committee.
I think she was the minority member at the time,
yeah.
But I'm not sure.
Yeah,
but she asked for them not to do that. The ACLU was suing under a FOIA request to have them released. A judge had an order for them not to do that, and she went ahead and destroyed the tapes. So it's interesting that she's only following orders when it involves torture, but when she's, you know, ordered not to destroy public records, which is something that every public employee knows, you know, you don't do that. Suddenly she can no longer follow orders, which is really sort of says a lot about her.
I kind of chuckled too at the beginning of the hearing where Senator Burr, the chairman of the Intelligence Committee, Republican senator from North Carolina, talked about her spine of steel. Do you remember this?
I don't remember that line. I know they said repeatedly that she spoke truth to power. That was said at
please.
Least three or four times. And I'm just like, when?
Well, he mentioned also this spine of steel that she had, but she apparently didn't have a spine of steel when told to destroy these tapes. She could have stood up to Jose Rodriguez, the godfather of the CIA's torture program, and then the head of the Counterterrorism Center. And she didn't.
There's conflicting reports as to what her role in it. Jose Rodriguez has said that she knew what he was doing when he wrote the cable. She claims she didn't know she was writing the cable to destroy them. She just thought he was going to show them someone higher up. She claimed during the hearing today that Rodriguez had retracted that statement about the tape destruction when he hadn't. She said multiple times the CIA always follows the law during the hearing, which I found really
laughable.
Obviously amusing, yes. She was under oath, so that sounds like perjury to me. But I mean, just a number of ridiculous things were said during the hearing today along the lines. CIA always follows the law. They're a very moral agency. They hold themselves to a higher moral standard than the rest of the world. That sort of thing. And here is somebody who was involved in torture. And, you know, she keeps saying she's not going to bring back the detention and interrogation program because it's outside the area of expertise of the CIA and that they learned tough lessons after 9/11 about doing things that were outside their expertise, as though doing something you're not that familiar with would lead you to strip someone naked and slam them into a wall repeatedly. I mean, I don't know very much about detaining or interrogating people, but I would not do that. If you look at what the Abu Ghraib soldiers were prosecuted, it was assault, it was battery, it was street level crimes. I mean, everybody knows that, you know, slamming someone into a wall, waterboarding someone, confining them into a box the size of a coffin, these are crimes. I mean, you don't have to have like an in-depth knowledge of like the law of armed conflict, U.S. constitutional law. It's assault and battery.
You know, this is an important issue too. And it's one that was raised at the time in 2002 and ignored. And that is that the CIA never had an interrogation program. There was no interrogation training course. You were just told to go in and do it. And until they actually came up with these so-called enhanced interrogation techniques, people were just winging it out in the field. And in many cases, winging it included beating prisoners, freezing prisoners, keeping them awake for days and days at a time. And there was no oversight.
Yeah, and there was also the two psychologists who helped design the program. And this is another interesting tidbit. They were being sued by the ACLU, and they wanted to bring in Gina Haspel as a witness to, in their defense, that she had ordered them to do this. And when it became possible, and the U.S. government refused to let her testify, saying state secrets, and when it became clear she wasn't going to be able to testify, they dropped their defense to that. Yeah, so that's further evidence that she was deeply and intimately involved in this program.
Unfortunately, that case was settled out of court, and so we'll never get to see what we otherwise would have seen in discovery and declassification.
Gina Haspel said today, along the lines of what Chip is saying, here's the quote, "We have decided to hold ourselves to a stricter moral standard." Like, what does that mean? We've decided, okay, we've spent a decade torturing people. By the way, Lawrence Wilkerson on this show said he thought quite a number of people had died as a consequence of torture. I think he thought the number might be as many as 100 around the world, because the CIA had set up black sites and secrets prisons, and they kidnapped people and tortured them, and without rendered them to other third parties where they could be tortured. But now we hold ourselves to a stricter moral standard. How do people in Congress listen to this from a torturer? We have decided to hold ourselves to a stricter moral standard. And how do they do that? And not only not complain, not shriek, not yell, not insist that this is the opposite of a stricter moral standard, unless the moral standard as such is so depraved that, you know, these words actually have no meaning.
I mean, and I believe she said that a number of times. One time was in response to from Kamala Harris, the senator from California. Do you think that the CIA interrogation programs are immoral? And she asked her repeatedly, and she refused point blank to say, one time saying, "I support the higher moral standard we were holding ourselves to." And Harris was like, "No, that you haven't answered my question." And the unfortunate thing is they all only had 5 minutes. So you could only ask Gina Haspel the same yes or no question so many times before you are just eating up your own time. And they do have to move on regretfully to ask her other questions for her to evade. So, I mean, I don't know what she's talking about. I suspect what she's trying to say is that torture was legal, and that the decision not to torture is, you know, us being a higher moral standard. Not that we ever did anything wrong, but now we're just being extra moral. Of course, that's completely nonsensical. I mean, everybody knows waterboarding, stripping someone naked and slamming them into a wall is illegal. I mean, you don't have to be well-versed in constitutional law to know that. And like I said, and this is a really important point, the U.S. soldiers at Abu Ghraib did some of these same things. They were prosecuted with street crimes. They were prosecuted for assault. They were prosecuted for battery. You know, if I did this, I would go to jail for assault or battery. And I didn't know this was illegal would be a very helpful defense in my case.
Or I was just following orders. You know, that's also a defense that in my view is unacceptable.
Didn't work very well at Nuremberg.
No, it didn't work well at Nuremberg. I've said over the years that I can actually understand. I disagree, but I understand if a line level journeyman CIA officer is told by his superiors that this has been cleared by the Justice Department, it's legal, go ahead and do it, and they do it. I get that. What I don't get is why no one was prosecuted in these deaths that Brian mentioned. So the CIA has admitted to two deaths. The press has reported four deaths. I think Larry Wilkerson is probably right. It's probably many dozens of deaths. Certainly Joe Hickman, a former Guantanamo guard, agrees with that and has written a book about quote unquote suicides that he witnessed at Guantanamo when he was a guard there in the CIA sector of that camp. Why were none of those people prosecuted? Certainly the Justice Department never told the CIA they could murder people while interrogating them.
We're looking forward, not backwards, was, I believe, what Obama said, though his administration was perfectly satisfied with looking backwards and reopening your case. You know, so once again, sort of like with Gina Haspel, just following orders, looking forward, not backwards, is also very selectively applied. So the only thing we can really reduce from this is that there is accountability and impunity for war criminals or war crimes when carried out by U.S. officials.
She told the committee that her moral compass is strong. I mean, again, this kind of banalities.
And we also know about her that she likes hockey and movies.
And Johnny Cash.
Because that's the only information that was declassified.
Johnny Cash was a progressive anti-racist, though, so I don't know. I don't think he'd be there. He's dead, so he can't protest. John, I want to, again, we've covered some of this territory, but I want to sort of see if we were out in the country and going around the United States and people were supporting Donald Trump or supporting Gina Haspel, or they could be Democrats, like many Democrats did. And they would say, well, torture's bad. It's ugly. But this was an ugly war. 9/11 happened. Thousands of people died. There was concern. There was worry that there were going to be other attacks. The ends, that is the goal of keeping, quote, America or Americans safe, justifies the means, even if they're ugly means. But let's just talk about that away from the moral issue and the legal issue. Let's just talk about it from the point of view of efficacy, of effectiveness, of does it keep America safe? Obviously, there's the downside, which is if you're torturing and droning people all over the world, they might not like America that much. They might feel resentful. But let's talk about your own experience, because, again, this is all rooted partly back in what happened in Pakistan, what happened in Afghanistan, what happened with Abu Zubaydah. Place Gina Haspel there and also what you observed and what you saw.
Sure. When I was in Pakistan as the chief of CIA counterterrorism operations, Gina Haspel was in headquarters as the chief of staff in the CIA's counterterrorism center. So she was several levels above me, two levels above me. And she had been a protege of Jose Rodriguez, who we said was the chief of the counterterrorism center at the time, and a notorious figure, mostly from Latin America and the 1980s inside the CIA. So we captured Abu Zubaydah in late March 2002. At the time, the CIA believed that he was the number three in al-Qaeda. That turned out to not be true. But he was rendered to a secret site. And he was interrogated by the FBI there. Ali Soufan, an FBI agent, an Arab American, created something of a relationship with Abu Zubaydah, a rapport with Abu Zubaydah, and he began to open up over a period of weeks, and he actually provided actionable intelligence, and that intelligence was twofold. It was, he gave us the identity of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who up to that time we knew only by his nom de guerre, Mukhtar, and he also told us how al-Qaeda was structured in Europe, what its cells looked like, which we really didn't know. It was important historical information. He didn't have any information on impending attacks, and it was because he was never actually in al-Qaeda. He had never joined. He had never pledged fealty to Osama bin Laden. But that didn't matter back at headquarters because they had convinced themselves that he was the number three and that the FBI was moving too slowly. And so in July 2002, George Tenet, the former CIA director, went to the White House and asked President Bush to withdraw the FBI from the secret site and to allow the CIA to take over the interrogation of Abu Zubaydah. For whatever reason, Bush did that. And on August 1st, just hours after taking over primacy in that case, the CIA began to torture Abu Zubaydah. Now,
this is many months after he's in custody.
Many months. We captured him at the end of March, and this was August the 1st. And remember, he's already been producing intelligence, and the FBI is reporting this intelligence back in their channels. Now, what the two contract psychologists did, Mitchell and Jessen, these were the two who were actually carrying out the torture, actually doing the torture, is when they realized he wasn't going to give them anything, and he completely clammed up. We know this from the Senate torture report. What they did is they took Ali Soufan's information from his FBI cables, they put it in CIA channels and said, look at this great intelligence he gave us. The torture's working. Well, in fact, that was a lie as well. And it was just to justify this horrid program and the $100 million that the American taxpayers paid to Mitchell and Jessen.
And they waterboarded him 83 times.
83 times. They later waterboarded Khalid Sheikh Mohammed 147 times. So yeah, this is not a one-shot deal.
They hung him from his arms. I'm talking again about Abu Zubaydah. They put him in a dog.
Forced nudity, a long-term nudity. They put him in a dog cage. They put him in a coffin. They put insects in the coffin because he had an irrational fear of insects. They chilled his cell to 50 degrees and threw ice water on him every hour. They kept him awake for 9 straight days, which caused him to hallucinate, and he had seizures and convulsions. At one point during the waterboarding, his heart stopped beating, and a doctor on site had to revive him just so they could torture him more. I mean, this is something to be ashamed of, not something to celebrate, not something to promote someone over.
Go ahead, Chip.
I mean, I think John's point is excellent. I mean, you should be going to jail for committing war crimes. You should not be getting promoted for them. And during the hearing, they actually asked Haspel if the program had produced any actionable intelligence. And she said it had, but she couldn't determine if it was due to the techniques used or not. That was her exact phrase. There was actionable intelligence produced, but I don't know if it was because of the techniques, which is the euphemism they use for torture, that were used. So, I mean, even Haspel won't come out and say it was really super effective.
And what did she do? What did Gina Haspel herself do?
Well, see, this is the point of contention. Gina Haspel eventually went out to the secret site. It was either at the very end of Abu Zubaydah's time there, or at the very beginning of Abdurrahim Aneshidi's time there. We know from not just the torture report, but from John Rizzo's, the general counsel, John Rizzo's autobiography and Jose Rodriguez's autohagiography, that Gina was there to be the chief of the secret site. So she would have been directly overseeing the torture of Abdurrahim Aneshidi. We also know from Neshidi's attorneys that he was tortured so mercilessly and so relentlessly that he lost his mind. And mind you, we're talking about 2002, 2003. He lost his mind, and he is still so crazy that he can't participate in his own defense.
Yeah, Chip Gibbons, we have 90 seconds left. Why do you think Trump could have nominated anybody? This was a controversial nomination. But why did Trump do it?
You know, Trump said he wanted to bring back torture. He was a huge and bombastic supporter of torture throughout the campaign trail. He, you know, said we're going to do worse than waterboarding because, you know, it's ineffective. It's what they deserve.
And he said we're going to kill their families.
Yes.
Does Haspel get confirmed?
I'm not clairvoyant, and it's hard to read situations like this. I would say of all of Trump's nominees, this is the one we have the best chance of defeating.
I think it's going to be close. I think she'll probably squeak through because the Democrats are generally spineless. I think she's going to make it. But we're out of time. We were joined here in the studio by Chip Gibbons. He's a policy and legislative counsel for Defending Rights and Dissent, as well as a journalist, and he's contributed to The Nation, Jacobin, and the book The Henry Kissinger Files. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll have more soon.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Today, we continue our regular weekly segment. It's every Wednesday, called Beyond Nuclear with Kevin Camps, where we look at nuclear issues, including nuclear weapons, nuclear energy, nuclear waste, and the future of nuclear technology in the United States. We're joined again in studio by Kevin Camps, the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. You can read his writings and the writings of the organization and get involved with them at beyondnuclear.org. And we're also joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Nicole Roussel. Nicole and Kevin, welcome back.
Thanks so much.
Thanks.
Well, the big news this week when it comes to nuclear issues, of course, is that our great leader, Donald Trump, has pursued, followed through with his campaign promise to destroy the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the Iran nuclear arms deal, which he said is the worst deal ever in history. And given the fact that there's a lot of bad deals, that's a high bar. Was it a bad deal?
Well, maybe it's the worst broken deal ever. You know, it's hard to exaggerate the significance of what Trump did yesterday. So I'm reminded of things we've talked about in past weeks where Saudi Arabia has made a move to build atomic reactors in its country, even though it's not only the Saudi Arabia of oil, it's not only the Saudi Arabia of solar power and wind power, it could get its electricity that way through renewables, for example. But instead, it's going down the nuclear power path, and they have said explicitly, it used to be the elephant in the room, the open secret, that Saudi Arabia, yeah, if they developed nuclear power plants, they could use them either through uranium enrichment, through plutonium reprocessing, to build a nuclear weapons arsenal. And that used to be the open secret, but the Saudi leadership has now said that that is their intention, that if Iran moves towards nuclear weapons, that Saudi Arabia will match it. And that's explicit. And so what Trump has done is he's really opened the door to the hardliners in Iran. And if they choose to develop nuclear weapons to return to that pathway of enriching uranium to, you know, higher and higher levels, up to weapons grade eventually, then it's a very serious nuclear arms race in the Middle East.
I think that's exactly what is going to happen. I think that's been the plan all along, where the Saudis are going to develop their own nuclear weapons program. We're going to look the other way, and so are the Israelis. And so in the unlikely event that the Iranians eventually someday develop a weapon, the Saudis are already going to have one. I think that's been the plan from the very beginning, and we're just pretending that we don't know anything about it.
Benjamin Netanyahu was all about this announcement from Donald Trump. Again, not surprising, given what Netanyahu's stated position has been. We had the Republican Party inviting Netanyahu, a foreign head of state, to come and speak before both houses of Congress, where he trashed the existing negotiations by the sitting U.S. president before both houses of Congress and got lots of ovation. So not a surprise that Benjamin Netanyahu did that. But I was noting a small news item yesterday that Mordecai Vanunu, the Israeli citizen who went to prison for 18 years, I believe, because he revealed the truth about Israel's nuclear program, he's been convicted again of violating his probation because he spoke to three Americans without permission a year ago. Israel has a nuclear weapons program.
Well, speaking of open secrets, it's been known for a long time, and Israel almost never will acknowledge that it has nuclear weapons, but obviously it's known worldwide that they do. So, you know, what's interesting about all this is a slow-moving Titanic hitting an iceberg, right? So back in the Bush-Cheney years, and Netanyahu and leadership in Israel at that time, you know, there were drums beating towards war. I mean, the United States was about to detonate a conventional blast in Nevada at the Nevada test site called Divine Strike, which was actually, even though it was ammonium nitrate and explosives, it was actually a test of a B-61 bomb to see how far down to dial it, because it's a dialable explosive, in order to take out Iranian subterranean nuclear facilities. This was back in like 2006, and we stopped that, luckily. But here we go again. And the crazy thing about Netanyahu is last week he had this, you know, unveiling of supposedly secret Iranian documents that, you know, they've been secretly developing nuclear weapons. Well, the point has been widely made by Obama administration officials who negotiated the deal, that that's exactly why the deal got negotiated. A lot to all of that was previously known many years ago. And the last thing, the last blast from the past I'll mention is, I happened to read a trade press article in 2006 that appeared suddenly and then it was gone. It wasn't reported again. And the gist of the article was, the reason that the Bush-Cheney administration is so hawkish on Iran right now is because the U.S. nuclear power industry is very displeased that it's losing business to the Russian nuclear power industry in Iran. And, you know, that kind of says a lot, right? And Saudi Arabia is courting the United States to build its nuclear power plants. It's courting other countries as well. So you have to wonder what's going on in the background of all this.
Yeah, I you know, this is the first time we've been shocked into speechlessness, I think, on this show. I didn't know any of that, to tell you the truth. I didn't know that there was this test that was scheduled in the Nevada desert as recently as 2006. But, you know, to tell you the truth, it makes me sad to the point of defeatism. Like, how hard do we have to work to stop this kind of stuff?
And the other thing—
Can it be stopped?
Yeah. Those are, I mean, that's the big issue, whether it can be stopped. Nicole, we have this weird Alice in Wonderland kind of situation where Donald Trump is condemning the Iran nuclear arms deal because he says it might someday allow Iran to develop a nuclear weapon, which Iran says it doesn't want. Whether that's true or not true, we don't know that. But they said they had a fatwa, a religious edict against nuclear weapons. So Trump says, we got to get out of this deal because someday it will allow Iran to have a nuclear weapon, even though currently the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, and all of these inspectors have come in and verified that Iran is in compliance with the deal, that they're not building a nuclear weapon. And at the same time, you have Israel embracing, applauding, supporting Trump's move. But Israel refuses to sign the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, refuses to publicly acknowledge its nuclear weapons, but does indeed have nuclear weapons. And yet somehow that's no big deal. In fact, nobody's saying a word about it in the U.S. Congress because the Democrats and the Republicans, it's not just Trump, they're all cool with it. I mean, it's shocking, really. It is Alice in Wonderland. Things are turned upside down.
It is shocking. It is heartening in some ways that the Democrats and the Republicans, well, at least the Democrats, are talking a little bit about the Iran deal. This was a good deal. This was one of the strictest deals that has existed. And we know the IAEA has done, you know, incredibly stringent inspections, more so than in any other country. So it's good that at least that is being talked about. But you're totally right that we haven't heard anything about, as we talked about last week, that the U.S. has broken the nuclear non-proliferation treaty and that, you know, Israel is not going in for any inspections whatsoever. We haven't heard any of that. It just seems like, you know, the U.S. and its friends are the only people who are allowed to boss other countries around.
That's what it's about. It's about bossing countries around.
Speaking of the International Atomic Energy Agency, another incredible data point in this long history of the situation was Mohammed El-Baradei, the director of the International Atomic Energy Agency in the past, who, along with his staff at IAEA, won the Nobel Peace Prize because of their work in Iraq, because of their work in Iran, trying to stop wars by getting the facts out that no, Iraq does not have a nuclear weapons program. Our inspectors have found nothing. It was dismantled in the early 1990s, to the best of our understanding. So what did he have to say about this push in the Arab world for nuclear power? He said, still as director of the IAEA, the reason for this push by a dozen Arab countries, including Saudi Arabia, is so that they will have a pathway to nuclear weapons if they choose to take that pathway. He said that as director of the IAEA, whose mandate, as conflicted and schizophrenic as it is to keep a lid on nuclear weapons proliferation while promoting nuclear power's promotion. Obviously, he felt the need, as IAEA director, to keep a lid on nuclear weapons proliferation by pointing out that nuclear power expansion in the Arab world, and he's an Arabian Egyptian, so, you know, more credibility to what he said, was really about nuclear weaponry.
Yeah, I want to go back to some of the big politics and some of the big dangers that we're going to be witnessing in the coming weeks and months, maybe days. You know, Israel started bombing Syria and opened up bomb shelters around the Golan Heights, an area that Israel seized from Syria in 1967, in the June 67 war. Yesterday, clearly in coordination with Trump's speech. It all happened at once. And I think they're testing Iran to see if Iran will retaliate. And if Iran does retaliate, that then becomes the foundational pretext for another escalation. We want to talk about all of those kind of things, Kevin, but because you're here and because you are an expert, unlike us, we want to talk about what the Iran nuclear deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, actually did, how it worked, how it became a verifiable sort of mechanism on this. Because Iran gave up quite a bit in exchange for the promise of relief from economic sanctions. It gave up quite a bit, including a limitation of its own sovereignty, I would say. Go ahead.
Well, as Nicole pointed out, the very intrusive inspections by the International Atomic Energy Agency, that was a huge rollback on Iranian sovereignty because the IAEA inspectors were allowed to go most to all places in the country to make sure that Iran was living up to its word. And what that word was a major decrease in uranium enrichment, the deactivation of a very large number of its uranium enrichment centrifuges, and the promise, the commitment that it would only enrich to a certain level. A level of something like 5% uranium-235 or less, which would guarantee that it's for nuclear energy production or nuclear medical isotope production. Because in order to get to weapons grade, you have to be at least 20%, more like 90% uranium-235. And in addition to that, it did things like not only deactivated, but made permanently shut down with the introduction, I believe, of concrete poured in of a plutonium production reactor. So major steps taken by the Iranian government, the Iranian nuclear establishment to guarantee that these were for real. This was a for real 15-year suspension of nuclear weapons activities. And the irony of Trump's move is, you know, if the depending on how the Iranians react, they could reactivate, and the hardliners are saying this is what they're going to do, reactivate those nuclear activities, return to higher levels of uranium enrichment, for example. So that's the unprecedented nature of this deal. And then in return, what Iran got was a lifting of very harsh sanctions that its economy has suffered under for many years. And that's slow going, but there had been some, you know, expansion of oil sales to various countries. So that's what remains to be seen, is if the European partners in this deal, countries like Germany, like the UK, like France, who tried so urgently to stop Trump from doing this, if they will continue in their business relationships with Iran or not, and how the U.S. would respond to that.
So, Kevin, can you tell us a little bit more about the technical aspects of, so if Iran does decide that they want to reactivate some of their nuclear work, what does that look like? How long does that take? Do they need resources from other places? Is this something, what's the timeline for this?
I don't think that returning to higher and higher levels of uranium enrichment would take very long at all if Iran chose to do that. They would simply have to reactivate those systems. And remember, another blast from the past was the U.S. and Israel, it looks like, military intelligence introduction of the Stuxnet computer virus into the world to try to take out those Iranian centrifuges, and they were successful. They also took out some other things like personal computers and business computers.
Yeah, they shut down the Jordanian internet system.
Yes. So that was one of the first applications of cyber warfare in history, even though it had been warned about for a long time. But, you know, Iran obviously rectified that at some point and got things going again. But that's the problem with uranium centrifuge enrichment technology, is it's too efficient, you know. If you have a very small number of these super efficient centrifuges hidden in a garage in any major city in the world, it'd be difficult for intelligence services from even Western countries to identify it. The only thing that would really give it away, besides very low level of radioactive output coming out in air emissions, would be the massive use of electricity. But as the efficiency got better, even that electricity usage has gone away. So it's very easily hidden. And the only next step that we're seeing in the world is laser enrichment, which unfortunately the Australians and the US are promoting as an entrepreneurial business idea. But if you have laser enrichment, that's really what I was trying to identify with that garage in an urban area, less so with the centrifuges. That does take a major facility. But those laser enrichment technologies, you could hide in a very small building with very little fingerprint to give it away. That's the danger of weapons proliferation we're facing in this ever more highly technological world we live in.
And Trump, in his speech, complained about the sunset part of the agreement of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, meaning that at some point, this 15-year period comes to an end, and that at that moment, the Iranian government would be fully capable of, like in short order, producing a nuclear weapon. In other words, that's kind of the core of his argument. What do you say to that?
Well, the estimates before the deal was hammered out was that Iran could be as little as a year away from nuclear weapons technology. And we've seen a real world example of how fast breaking that can go in North Korea. And then if you mate the weapons technology to the missile, which North Korea hasn't quite gotten to yet because of reentry into the Earth's atmosphere for these intercontinental ballistic missiles, then you're in big trouble. You have a fully operational nuclear weapons arsenal that can reach most places in the world. So in Iran's case, you know, the estimate was a year out from nuclear weapons capability. If they chose to go there, like you said, the religious leader of the country said, we are not doing that. That's against our religion. So, that, you know, the Iranians, to their credit, have given lots of opportunities for the West to respond in kind. And this is Trump's response, you know, a very hard line. That's an understatement position. So it can break quickly. Just another example of how quickly things can break is Japan. It's been known for decades, really. Japan is so high tech and has a huge nuclear power program, including separated plutonium, that within weeks, literally within weeks, if Japan chose to, it could be a nuclear weapons power. But you have the Hibakusha from Hiroshima and Nagasaki. You have a very strong peace movement in Japan. You have a constitutional provision that says Japan will never again be a military aggressor in the world. That's under pressure from the likes
under pressure
of,
from the government, from Abe.
From
Shinzo
Abe, yes.
You know, I want to go, Kevin, to the article that's, I'm looking at it from Associated Press. President Hassan Rouhani warned Tuesday, this story's a day old, he warned Tuesday that Iran could restart enriching uranium, quote, without any limitations, close quote, within weeks after Trump pulled America out of the nuclear deal. Although he said world powers still in the accord could potentially save the pact. So he's talking about Germany and France and the UK. And of course, Russia and China are the other two signers. But if they don't find a way to save the agreement, they're going to go forward. Now, the thing that's interesting about this, there's many little and important interesting things here, but you mentioned the hardliners who are, you know, in Iran's political vernacular called the principalists, meaning more like the Iran Revolutionary Guard and people like that. And then there's others who are moderates. Rouhani is one of the moderates in Western political vernacular. So what we see, and it makes perfect sense, that the position of those who said, look, this was a bad idea to organize, to negotiate with America. You can't trust America. They're going to weaken us, and then we're going to be susceptible to attack from America or from Israel with its 200 to 400 nuclear weapons and not being a member of the NPT. So it appears to me that all of the political trends, tendencies, factions within Iran are as a consequence of Trump's unilateral action, congealing around the former position of the principalists, the hardliners.
Well, you mentioned Netanyahu's speech to a joint session of the U.S. Congress, and what keeps occurring to my mind is that the hardliners in Iran and the hardliners in the U.S., like Senator Cotton from Arkansas, they sound a whole lot alike, except on opposite sides of the issue. So when the hardliners are calling the shots and Trump has gone along with the hardliners in the U.S., that can lead to very bad things. And so just to reemphasize my point about the uranium enrichment technology, in Iran, those sites are well known where they're at because centrifuges do take a large facility. And that was a part of the intrusive inspections. And so, you know, now that the gloves are potentially coming off, that's the scary thing, whether it would be a conventional military conflict or nuclear conflict. Again, that blast in Nevada in 2006 that was planned, the only reason we heard about it was the Department of Energy under Bush and Cheney held a press conference in Vegas and literally said it'll be the first mushroom cloud visible from Vegas in a generation. Isn't that great? It was a conventional blast, and the way we stopped it, an attorney in Toledo named Terry Lodge, working with a researcher in Michigan named Michael Keegan, determined that the radioactivity at the Nevada test site that would be blasted up in that conventional blast mushroom cloud would rain out downwind because they did so much above ground testing in Nevada and they never cleaned it up. And so that's how it was stopped. National Environmental Policy Act, the Department of Energy hadn't even looked at the contamination on the ground. And that was the good news was, you know, that beating of the drums of war in 2006 was stopped. It happened at the same time as that very suspicious movement of several nuclear warheads in the United States, unpermitted, but nuclear weapons were moving around in the country accidentally, you know. So here we are in 2018, and it's a lot more serious because this is official government policy at this point.
Doesn't seem like nuclear warheads can just accidentally move around, does it?
Well, it's happened, and it happened at that same time, which made it even more suspicious.
Yeah, we're speaking with Kevin Camps. He's the radioactive waste watchdog with Beyond Nuclear. We talk with Kevin every Wednesday about nuclear issues, nuclear weapons, nuclear technology, nuclear waste, all things nuclear. And you can check out Kevin's work and learn about his organization by going to beyondnuclear.org. One of the important things that I think you're telling us, Kevin, and people might not understand it, is the seamlessness in a way between nuclear energy production and nuclear weapons production, that it's not like some sort of great continental divide separating them. And one of the things that happened, and I want to turn this to North Korea, if I could, In 1994, there was almost a war between the United States and North Korea. And the United States dispatched Jimmy Carter, who met with Kim Il-sung. There were other top envoys. There was an agreement signed called the 1994 General Framework Agreement, whereby North Korea agreed to give up its nuclear weapons program and even to shut down a nuclear energy program in exchange for the United States leading an international effort to build a light water nuclear reactor so that they could substitute that as an energy source. And of course, DPRK was going through a very tough time because the Soviet Union had collapsed, the Eastern and Central European governments that were their trade partners and providing spare parts for a lot of their infrastructure, they had stopped trading with them. And then one of the big reasons that the North Koreans gave for basically abandoning the 1994 General Framework Agreement was the U.S. just didn't start building a light water reactor. In other words, just was trying to drain them literally of energy with the idea of regime change. Now, we have new negotiations coming up between Trump and Kim Jong-un. Everybody's looking forward to it. What's the takeaway for the North Koreans, given what Trump just did with the JCPOA?
Yeah, that's a huge theme of this, is how can the United States be trusted to fulfill its obligations and its promises and its solemn oath under, you know, the JCPOA was not a treaty, but it was a pretty high profile agreement between, you know, some of the most powerful countries on earth. And the U.S. has decided to withdraw just a few years after its signing. So, you know, a odd thing about that 1994 agreement was that one of the companies involved in supposedly building those Western light water reactors was a Swiss company called ABB, and Donald Rumsfeld was on the board of that company. So it's just odd, the players that are involved in some of this. But your point that uranium enrichment, which feeds nuclear power, its fuel, can also be used if you enrich to 90% levels instead of 5% or less to nuclear weapons, usable uranium, highly enriched uranium. On the other side, plutonium extraction from high-level radioactive waste can also be used once separated for weapons purposes. So that was Mohammed El-Baradei's warning, was that if a country like Saudi Arabia gets a hold of either enrichment or reprocessing, they can use it to build nuclear weapons.
I think the incredibly surprising thing, too, is that the JCPOA had so many U.S. allies on it as well. And when we're looking at this North Korean summit, which, as you mentioned, Brian, everyone's looking forward to, it's just these two parties meeting. And so, you know, if we can't trust the U.S. to go and negotiate with its friends and its allies, you know, with Iran, how on earth can anyone trust that the U.S. would stay with, you know, just the U.S. and North Korea?
And by extension, why would any country trust us to engage in diplomacy if they see what we've done now with the Iranians, they see what we've done with the Libyans, what we may do with the North Koreans, certainly what we've done in the past? I don't know why anybody would sit across the table from us. You just can't trust us.
Yeah. And I don't think North Korea does trust the United States, especially North Korea. But they're still negotiating because they have some goal in mind. And we have Kim Jong-un, who's back in China for a second surprise trip, meeting with Xi Jinping prior to the meeting with Donald Trump. Anyway, it's a big issue, Kevin, about North Korea, because Ukraine, following the collapse of the Soviet Union, it gave up its nuclear weapons. South Africa, when the black-led, majority-led government took power, said, we're going to get rid of our nuclear weapons. I think those are the only two cases where a nuclear power actually gave up nuclear weapons. Where do you see this going?
Like you said, with Ukraine, I think Belarus and Kazakhstan at the time also gave back their nuclear warheads to Russia, essentially. So, you know, the thing is, North Korea has nuclear weapons. And I recall a speech given by Noam Chomsky in Washington, D.C., right around the time of the 2003 U.S. invasion of Iraq. And his point was there are some basic rules to U.S. warfare. And the first rule of all is that your adversary has to be modern warfare, has to be completely defenseless. And his point, even then, the war drums against Iran were already being beaten in the United States. And his point was, you know, Iran has a pretty powerful conventional military, things like torpedoes in the Persian Gulf that could shut the whole place down at the Straits of Hormuz, for one thing. So he was saying that the United States really should think twice about attacking Iran because there could be repercussions for that. So that's the scary part, is there are hardliners in Iran who now can make the argument, we need to race for nuclear weapons. Whether or not they would prevail in their society to get permission to do that is another thing. But North Korea already has nuclear weapons. Granted, they perhaps would not survive reentry on an ICBM. You know, there are other ways to deliver nuclear weapons. Einstein, in his 1939 letter to Roosevelt, his scenario saying that the United States should start a crash program on nuclear weapons was an adversary with a nuclear explosive could float it into a port on a boat, detonate it, take out the port and the surrounding region. That was Einstein's warning to Roosevelt in 1939 to try to convey the power of nuclear weapons. Of course, those are tiny compared to what we're talking about these days. And so what's to stop a North Korea from literally putting a nuclear warhead on a boat and hiding it somewhere to be deployed? So those are the kind of things. There's so much attention on the ICBMs. There's other ways of delivering nuclear weapons, unfortunately.
And I also note, in terms of the tone, at least, we can't be predictive about where the DPRK is going in terms of its negotiating position. But one of the things is they are for denuclearization. They're also, when you read their own language, they're also suggesting so must the rest of the world be for denuclearization, because the world is committed to denuclearization formally through the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. It would seem to me that the DPRK, recognizing that it was the United States that introduced nuclear weapons into the Korean Peninsula area starting in 1958, would be looking for some other guarantees. But in fact, the U.S. doesn't really, I mean, the guarantees are a bit meaningless when you have like Trident submarines and other nuclear armed platforms all over that region.
Beatrice Finn of the International Campaign for the Abolition of Nuclear Weapons warned at the Nobel Peace Prize ceremony in December, either we abolish nuclear weapons or they will abolish us. Those are the choices we're left with. But similar warnings go back to John Kennedy in the early 1960s. He warned about the sword of Damocles hanging over our head. And as Nicole pointed out earlier, the United States made a solemn commitment in an international treaty called the Non-Proliferation Treaty, as did the other nuclear weapons powers, to, in good faith, negotiate for the abolition of these weapons. And that was the better part of a half century ago at this point, and they haven't gotten around to it. And that was why the non-nuclear weapons states in this world formed another treaty saying these things are illegal, we have to get rid of them. They are in the process of ratifying that treaty. It is on the books now at the United Nations, and the ICAN organization helped at the grassroots level internationally to get that treaty through last year. So that's the hopeful thing, is that the rest of the world is finally standing up to the nuclear weapons powers.
We're going to leave it right there. We've been joined in studio by Kevin Camps, as we are every week. Kevin is the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. And we've also been joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Nicole Roussel. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a brief break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.